This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall tells us a ghost story for Halloween. As well, he'll read a poem penned by Edgar Allan Poe back in the mid-1800s. Still with the Halloween theme, stay tuned to hear about a haunted barn on the north side and an interview from our newsroom on a number of housing projects spearheaded by New Dawn. That's up first with Dave DeVoe and spokesperson Elise McLean.
So, Elise, you've just informed me New Dawn has a new initiative ongoing, educating tenants. Tell me about that.
Sure. So earlier this year, New Dawn was granted funding through the Community Housing Transformation Center to run a project around tenant education and advocacy. And specifically, what we're doing is running some workshops across the CBRM and inviting tenants, anyone who, you know, rents a unit or a home in the CBRM to come and learn about their rights and responsibilities as a tenant. And then what we're also doing as part of the initiative is we're going to be creating some materials to inform people about rights and responsibilities that they have. And also we're asking people about kind of their thoughts on the concept of a CBRM Tenants Association. We don't currently have any type of advocacy association for tenants in the CBRM, and it is common for other, you know, other places around Nova Scotia have these types of associations. And so we're just kind of asking the question, asking tenants, like, you know, what would they think if we were to have an association for tenants, and what might the work of that be? And we're just kind of asking people while we have them in the room what they would think of a CBRM Tenants Association.
Okay, could you say a little bit about the context in which this idea has arisen? Obviously, we do have housing challenges around here. Is that part of the impetus for this, or?
Yeah, it absolutely is. So the funder, the national funder I mentioned earlier, the Community Housing Transformation Center, they have a fund that's called the Community-Based Tenant Initiative Fund. And they recognize, I think it's, you know, we feel it in the CBRM, but certainly nationally, you know, housing is a really hot topic. Housing is an issue in a lot of places, and a lot of people, perhaps more than ever, are finding themselves that they have to rent, and they have to rent for longer periods of time because people cannot afford to purchase homes. And so the idea of this fund is really to try to give agency back to people who rent and you know, make them feel a bit of a sense of power, because you are very vulnerable as a renter, you know, in any community. There's certainly many wonderful landlords, but unfortunately there's some people who might try to take advantage of you as well. And so we recognize in the CBRM, we have a lot of seniors who rent. We have a lot of newcomers in our community who maybe English is not their first language, and they're also renting. And so we felt like it was a pretty justifiable environment to run this type of program, to try to access as many people as possible who rent, just to say, you know, you do have rights and you do have responsibilities that apply to you as a tenant. And if people are experiencing any issues, there are paths and processes for them to access to help, get help with those issues.
You mentioned that there are some people that may be taken advantage of. Have you heard of such cases? And if so, I mean, obviously I'm not asking you to divulge personal details, but like,
sure.
what stories of that sort have you heard, and what patterns do you see there?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's pretty heartbreaking. It's really hard to hear the stories that I've heard, you know, in conversation with everyone that I have, you know, chatting with people, you know, people like the Cape Breton Students Union and the Ally Center and, you know, various types of organizations that have a large population of people who rent. I've heard all sorts of really heart-wrenching stories around, you know, people coming home and the locks are changed on their home and they aren't able to get in, or people you know, there's one individual who was told that their living room is not a public space, and so the landlord could enter the living room without giving 24 hours notice, which is not true. You know, the threshold of your door is the private space, and they do need to have 24 hours notice or your expressed permission to enter the unit. You hear of newcomers where English is not their first language, and, you know, they're trying to read the Residential Tenancies Act, which is, you know, pretty pretty hard. You know, there's lots of jargon in that legislation. There's a lot of legalese, and it's difficult for an English speaker to read and understand. So there's, you know, and you also hear of conditions, you know, people, the floors in the apartment are dirt, or, you know, there's like infestation. It's awful. So there are some really, really awful, atrocious situations that just absolutely break your heart to hear. And we just want to do, you know, it's what we're doing isn't certainly not going to solve the problem, but it might make a small dent in the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think a little bit more attention is coming to issues like that, like with the Stacey Gomez case in Halifax, with which I'm sure you're quite familiar. Have cases like that sort of raised awareness about the problems you just identified or not, do you think?
Sure. I'm sorry. Could you just repeat that question?
Yeah, the Stacey Gomez case.
Not familiar with that.
The Stacey Gomez was a tenant in Halifax who was going to get rent evicted, but she actually successfully appealed.
Oh, yes.
And now she's being taken to small claims court. I think that the landlord has actually appealed the finding of the tenancy board. But I mean, you know, it was lots of coverage of that. You know, I guess, not being an expert on this, I would speculate that maybe that sort of drew a bit more attention to it. But I don't know. I mean, is that something you think would sound plausible, that a case like that might sort of, you know, draw more attention to the problem and maybe help solve it?
Yep. Perhaps, yeah, maybe. Certainly rent evictions is a really hot word right now, and I've heard lots of that, and both in the media and just sort of through my day-to-day work, people talking about rent evictions. And they are really popular, and really what it points to is a deficiency of the Residential Tenancies Act, because there's all sorts of gray areas that exist in the Residential Tenancies Act, and I think that piece of legislation could certainly use a lot of tightening up, and a lot of it needs a lot of clarity over those gray areas, because a landlord can evict a tenant if they're going to be doing necessary renovations, but, you know, what's the definition of necessary, and what's the threshold at which you're able to evict a tenant? And we hear all the time of landlords kind of wanting to increase rent. They're unable to increase it by more than 2% due to the rent cap that's currently in place until December 2023. And so they come up with, oh, I need to do such and such renovation. I need to evict my tenant, and then lo and behold, they put the apartment back on the market, and the rent has doubled or increased by, you know, 30%, 40%, 50%. So it is absolutely a thing right now. Rent evictions are happening, and I've heard of a few examples of people going, taking it to the Residential Tenancies Court, and it getting dealt with. And in some instances, I have heard that the tenants are successful in sort of proving that it was not a legal eviction. But I think all of that points to real deficiencies in the Residential Tenancies Act as a piece of legislation, and we need a lot more clarity around some parts of that legislation.
Yeah, I know you're not a lawyer, I guess, but I mean, what do you think is the fix there for the legislation?
I am certainly not a lawyer. I would not, you know, I also don't write legislation, but I just think there are a few areas in there where there are gray areas around, especially eviction, and just further clarity would be very helpful. So renovations is one. There's also a bit of a gray area around you can evict someone if you yourself as a landlord are going to need to occupy that unit. So, for instance, if it's like a home and you rent out your basement, and let's say you have a baby, you know, and you want, okay, now we need that basement, you can evict a tenant for that reason as well. But there's some gray area in that, you know. So I think in particular around evictions, because that's such an extreme move to make, and there is typically, in this type of an environment, there is great benefit to the landlord to evict you, because then they can increase the rent, and there's a, everybody's looking for housing, so there's, they're not, the unit will not be vacant for long. And then of course it's a great risk to the tenant, because anyone who's renting right now is struggling terribly to find places to live. So yeah. I just think, I don't know, as you say, I'm not a lawyer, I don't know exactly what would need to go into it, but I think having additional clarity provided to some of those clauses in the legislation would, at the very least, make things, you know, whether it's in the benefit of the landlord or benefit of the tenant, whatever it might be, it would just provide more clarity.
Okay. I just want to touch on a couple of more issues. I know you're probably going to cover all these issues with people at your session, but just for those who are listening who might not be able to attend, one issue I see coming up a lot is confusion over damage deposits and how they work, and stories of people asking for damage deposits when it's not clear to the tenant whether they should actually be required to give it. What are the rules around that?
Yeah, I'll say I don't know like a ton of details about that, and we do get into that in the session a little bit, but they can ask you to pay a damage deposit. That is typically, I believe is it half of your first month's rent or the amount of your first month's rent. And then you can get it back at the end of your tenancy, as long as, you know, the unit is in good condition and all of that stuff. I myself rented in the CBRM for 6 years, and I rented, I don't know, probably from 10 different landlords in that time, and certainly ran into many landlords who did not want to give me the damage deposit back. I think that's a real point of contention. But I think the thing that we really try to drive home in the workshops is that no matter what the issue is, there is a process to deal with it. And that is to, you know, go to, we have all sorts of resources for people to point you in the right direction. But basically there are forms for you to get through the Access Nova Scotia website. You can fill out the form, you can file it, like there's a process for it. So, I mean, it is sad, and we come across people who have issues with damage deposits. They have issues with, you know, my plumbing is broken, or they're not plowing the driveway like they said they would. Like there's, as you can imagine, there's a litany of issues that people can come across. But the point that we try to drive home in our sessions is like, there is a process to deal with it. There are resources available to you. Luckily, very fortunately, we connected with some awesome folks at Nova Scotia Legal Aid. They also are coming to each of our workshops across the CBRM, so that people can ask really specific questions and get some really solid answers from the Nova Scotia Legal Aid folks, because they are also kind of a tool in your tool chest when it comes to dealing with any issues with your landlord.
Another issue I hear about sometimes is people encountering difficulties when they're changing from annual to month, or the other way around, or to a fixed. I mean, like, what are tenants' rights and landlords' responsibilities on that?
Absolutely. So everyone who rents a unit or a home in the CBRM or in Nova Scotia, you have a lease. Whether or not you have signed a piece of paper or not, a lease applies to you. If you have signed a lease, then you know, your landlord would have outlined whatever the terms of the agreement are. It might be a year, it might be, and maybe that lease is month to month. It's whatever your landlord decides, or you decide. It could be multiple years. When the date of that lease ends, the landlord does have the right to evict you once that date passes. However, if you do not sign anything, if you just move in and you've never signed a piece of paper, you automatically default to, they call it a standard form lease in Nova Scotia, and that means that you are automatically are in a month-to-month agreement with your landlord. So if you want to leave the unit, you have to give 1 month's notice. If the landlord wants to evict you for just no reason, really, or, you know, a reason, whatever the reason might be, they have to give you 4 months notice. And there's all sorts of details within that standard form lease, and you can find it on the Access Nova Scotia website. And again, we have all these resources available both on our website, which is cbrmtenant.ca, and we have the resources printed for people at our workshops as we're hosting them. But so you do have a lease, no matter if it's you signed a piece of paper or you didn't. A lease agreement does apply to you. And even if you signed a paper agreement, landlords must follow the Residential Tenancies Act within that agreement. Like, they can't include things in there that go against the Residential Tenancies Agreement. So there are all sorts of little things in there around leases. But again, the point that we want to drive home to people is, like, there are resources available, you know, so if people don't have a lease or they have questions or they're worried about something, you know, we are a resource for the time being, as long as this project is running, which currently it runs until March 2023. So we're just trying to inform as many people as possible about, like, resources through Access Nova Scotia and resources through Nova Scotia Legal Aid.
And finally, Elise, just for those who might not be able to make it to the workshop, what are the avenues of appeal available to people?
Sure. So I'll say for anyone who can't make it, so we have five more workshops that are scheduled. In Sydney Mines, Sydney, Glace Bay, and New Waterford. And we have a virtual workshop. So if you go, again, to the website, cbrmtenants.ca, you can sign up for the virtual workshop, which will be on December 1st. And we're going to host it at 1 o'clock on December 1st. If you also can't make that time, we are going to record that workshop and we'll upload it to YouTube and we'll share the link with anyone who registered. So you can always go back and watch it at another time.
Okay. So, I was actually going to ask you, like, avenues of appeal for tenants or landlords.
Sure.
But I mean, I guess if you're going to upload, those details would be contained in those workshops, I take it.
Absolutely.
So I think people will be covered there.
Yes, and let's say, you know, but of course, if someone has an issue at any time, they can go to the Access Nova Scotia website. Typically, most issues are dealt with, this form is called a J form. So if you go to the Nova Scotia, you know, if you could just Google, like, Access Nova Scotia, you know, residential tenancy J form, it should be one of the first results that come up, or you could navigate through the Nova Scotia, Access Nova Scotia website, and find that J form. Most issues are dealt with disputes through the J form, or you could contact Nova Scotia Legal Aid. They do have an individual who's in Sydney, who's wonderful and can help you. And another thing we're really encouraging people to do is, if you have any issues with your landlord at any time, keep a written record of that. So if you are asking your landlord to fix a leaky tap, you know, and you're asking and asking and asking, make sure you are tracking in writing, even ideally it would be through an email exchange to your landlord, or even just keep a journal. I guess, like, that's an absolutely valid form of tracking. If you just write an entry in a journal and date it, that is valid. And if, let's say, it eventually got to small claims court or something like that, that is a valid form of like tracking, so of proof, you know. So if there's any issues you're having, do your best to always, if you have a verbal conversation with them, go home and follow up with an email, or go home, write it in some type of a journal and date it, time and date, so that you have record of that. Other than that is Access Nova Scotia or Nova Scotia Legal Aid.
Okay. With that sound advice, anything else you'd like to add, Elise?
I would just say, yeah, we have five more workshops coming up. Four in person and one more virtual. Head to cbrmtenants.ca. We'll be updating that website over time, and we'll also be, yeah, we're exploring this idea of a CBRM Tenants Association, and we would love anyone's feedback on that. So our email address, info@newdawn.ca, is also on the website, and people are, like, really, really encouraged. Please reach out, and if you have any thoughts or feelings about it, CBRM Tenants Association, we would really love to hear them.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time, Elise. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much for your time. Have a great
day.
Okay,
you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have something a little different for you on The Good Sentence this week. Halloween on a Hilltop Farm, as recounted by Jim St. Clair in the Inverness Oran and read by Paul McDougall. Then stay tuned for Paul to read The Raven, and that's by the famous late storyteller Edgar Allan Poe.
As a young lad of 9, I went with my parents and my 4 younger siblings to live on a hilltop farm which had been deserted for some years. My father had decided that he did not wish to spend most of his life underground, away from the sun and the fresh air. In his thick, cheerful voice with his Belgian accent, he said, "We will live on a high hill with a great view of mountains and the sea and with lots of healthy air. We will be happy there." Although the place was buffeted by strong winds daily and had a somewhat eerie feeling when the rain clouds obscured the view, our first months there were very happy. Our vegetable garden grew well. The several cows and sheep, which my father and mother purchased, seemed to prosper in the grass-filled pasture, and our chickens laid many eggs. As children, we had designated a flat space between the house and the barn as a place to play ball or tag. As we were far from schools, our mother taught us our school lessons around the kitchen table in the mornings. Our father taught tricks with playing cards in the evenings. All seemed to be in good prospect for the future on the hilltop farm that had been deserted for so many years. We had very few visits from the neighbors who lived at the base of the hill, but they welcomed us to their home. The harvest season brought many ripe vegetables from the garden to be stored in the dry cellar under the kitchen floor. The barn filled with ripened hay and oats, even for the winter, it seemed. In fact, there was very little space left in the barn for a new half-ton truck our parents bought. As the autumn came on, all seemed well. Although the events of the first and only Halloween Eve we spent at our farm on the hilltop happened many years ago, they can never be forgotten. Late in the afternoon, the wind shifted to the north. In the evening twilight, the setting sun started to go down behind the trees at the edge of the fields behind the barn. The red rays of the disappearing sun tinged the gathering black clouds with a strange hue. The color of the sky was reflected in the mirror over the kitchen sink. The whole room seemed to take on a dark red tone, reminiscent of dried blood. A very odd occurrence. Our father went early to the barn to finish the evening chores and to bring fresh milk to the house. Believing he would return soon, we all sat down at the kitchen table to enjoy a meal of Belgian pancakes and jam. As the redness of the sky darkened, the wind seemed to come from all quarters of the sky at once, and then a huge flock of great black birds, the likes of which we had never seen before, landed on the bare ground of our playing field between the house and the barn. The 5 of us and our mother gathered at the kitchen window in astonishment as the birds screeched and filled the air with terrifying cries and began to dance around in a strange formation, strange creatures from some distant place who paid no attention to us. On flapping wings, they rose up in the air and came back down again and again. Each time they landed, they seemed larger and to take on the shape of aged people with hands with long fingers and pointed noses instead of claws and beaks. The feathers on their heads turned slowly into straggly strands of straw-colored hair. Their forms changed shape, and as they rose into the air, they went to nearby trees and gathered branches. When they landed again, they began to sweep the earth as though with brooms, cackling all the time. Far away, but carried by the wind, came the sound of a discordant fiddle on which was played a fast tune as though for dancing. As the noise became louder and louder and the rhythm faster and faster, the creatures danced more rapidly, laughing and screaming with haunting sounds. In distress, our usually calm mother began to call to our father to come back to the house, but he did not arrive. Then, in a panic, she forced us to leave the window and to go down the steep ladder to the cellar under the kitchen. Then she closed the trap door over us so we were in the dark, but could still hear the loud sounds of the strange creatures echoing in every corner of the house. Again and again our mother called to our father, but no response. We had no idea what had happened to him. Huddled together, we remained half awake as the night was still filled with disturbing cries and screeches and ridiculous laughter and the scratching of a raucous fiddler. Hours later, the night became silent. No wind, no sound of a discordant fiddle, no screeches of weird birds. We followed our mother back up into the kitchen. In the calmness of the early dawn, with its cheerful light, we looked out the window. All we could see were bunches of branches here and there, and our play field full of strange marks. And there, seated on a stump just outside the barn, was our father. His face was the color of wood ash, and his body seemed to sag with fatigue. His hair, once brown, had turned white overnight. Slowly he rose and came to the house. As he entered the door, in a voice with none of its usual good cheer, he said, "We are leaving here now." Later in the morning, with our household goods piled in the truck, and us older children guiding the cows and the sheep and the horse down the hill, we left the hilltop farm, never to return. Father never told us what he had seen or experienced, even after we settled on another farm far down the valley. His former joy and cheerfulness never returned to his voice or his face. He never told us jokes again or taught us tricks with playing cards as he once had. Life was very different. Though the years, some people have gone to the hilltop for brief visits, but never to stay, I would advise the curious to stay away, particularly on Halloween Eve. With horror, I still recall the events of that terrible night so many years ago when I, Alois de Wilde, was but a boy of 9. Who or what were those creatures? Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, "only this, and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, that it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door, darkness there, and nothing more." Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was but the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore, merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. "Surely," said I, "surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what there is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more." Open here I flung the shutter, when with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped the stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling,
by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art shorn, O craven, ghastly grin and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what the lordly name is on the night's plutonium shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marvel this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore, for we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, Nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken, doubtless, said I, and what it utters is its only stock and store, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven, still beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfume from an unseen censer swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lamour. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden, it shall clasp a sainted maiden, whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden, whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign in parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting, get thee back into the tempest and the night's plutonium shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul has spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas, just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor, and my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
Bradley from the Coast Morning Show has a Halloween treat for you as well.
Things are getting a lot scarier on the north side. With the Haunted Barn and the Cape Breton Exhibition Society coming together, it's on now through until the end of October. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the program from the Cape Breton Exhibition, Donnie McNeil. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you for having me back.
Before we even get into talking about the Haunted Barn, how was the exhibition this past summer?
The exhibition was just awesome. We were really, really happy with the outcome. Even though we had a little bit of rain the first day, once things dried up, we had an excellent crowd. Everybody was happy with some of the improvements and the changes. And it was just an overall good feeling and lots of anticipation for next year.
Yeah, and the tradition continues with the exhibition. And this is something that's been around for a while in different communities, but you guys decided to do this. And from all indications, your first couple of ones that you had at the exhibition, the Haunted Barn, is going over fantastic.
It certainly is. We've partnered up with the Haunted Barn Society and made our facilities available. And it couldn't be a better venue for them. They're making the best use of it, and people are really having a great time.
Now, it's called Darkness, Bones, and Blood, and I've seen some people online talking about it. It is scary, so you guys are recommended to be at least 12 years or older to go through, right?
Absolutely. It's not for the faint of heart. It's not for children. It is very scary, but it is also a lot of fun. And like I say, people are walking away after having a really great time.
And it's coming up this weekend again, the 20th, the 21st, and the 22nd. And then the following weekend, the 27th, 28th, and the 29th, it's between 7 and 10. But I'm guessing you should get there early because I'm sure there's going to be lineups because this is a big hit on the north side.
Yep. The closer we get to Halloween, the busier it seems to be getting. So I expect those last two weekends are going to be really popular. But what's nice about it is everything is indoors. Our lineup is indoors undercover. And we've got some food vendors on site for people. And the lineups aren't too long. But like you say, we expect it to get busy.
One thing that I must commend, John, you also have handicapped accessible for people that are handicapped and go through as well.
It is, yeah. And that's one of the things that we wanted to ensure. And, you know, some of the other sites around the area, some of the outdoor events really can't offer that. But it's one of the things that we thought was important.
Now, tickets are available at the door. Is that the only place you can get tickets?
Yeah, everything is at the door.
$15 at the door. I also see that you have an event coming up on the 30th between 2 and 6. Not so spooky, I guess you could say, for 12 and under and having it during the day so it doesn't scare the kids.
Exactly. It's going to be more of a lit-up event, and some of the more scary elements will be tamed down a bit just so the kids can get out and have some fun too prior to Halloween.
All right, Donnie, appreciate this, and good luck with it. You guys have been working hard to keep the exhibition going. This is one of many ways that you can bring the community together, also make it for generations to come with the exhibition, with events like this.
That's what we're going for.
Dr. Larry Campbell, PhD in chemistry from Purdue University, runs a small business in Milton, Ontario called Bedrock Scientific. He is a proud caper living abroad who gives a tip of the cap to some of his teachers while growing up in Westmount for sparking his interest in science, as well as his research into the tarpons when he was a university student.
Grew up initially in Lingan. I was born in City Hospital. That's no longer around. But my mom and dad lived out there, and they were both from New Waterford, and we moved to Westmount, which is a great place to be, right across from the beautiful city of Sydney. That's where I spent most of my childhood, if not all of it, you know, between growing up and going to Robin Foote Elementary and McLennan Junior High and then Riverview Rural High. That's sort of where life began, and the sort of love of all the things I've come to love are from.
Was it during your studies in school, junior high and high school, where you developed your interest in science?
Oh, absolutely. The love of science was there right from the beginning. There were so many great teachers that I had growing up through, you know, all the schools that I was going to. Had a lot of fun with biology and chemistry in high school. And, yeah, it was just something that seemed to come naturally.
So were you interested in science at that time? Did you start to imagine that you could make a living out of doing this and someday you would be a chemist or a scientist as a career?
Yeah, I think it really sort of took off, Bill, in high school when I sort of got really interested in environmental chemistry and how we were impacted as Cape Bretoners by the tar ponds. And that really sort of drew me to learn more about environmental feature and the impact it was having in our environment. It actually came back when I was at Acadia in my early university days, when I came back and did a project looking at the PCB levels in mussels that we pulled out of Sydney Harbor. So that was quite an exciting experience too.
That seems like a very interesting project. So when you were studying at Acadia, here you are preparing for an assignment back in your hometown, a place, an environment you'd be very familiar with the subject matter. Can you talk a little bit about that research, Larry, and what did you learn from it?
That was a tremendously fun project. I had a professor there. His name was Scott Daniels at Acadia, and he was from the Hamilton area originally. It was really fun, you know, introducing him to tide tables, because you just can't go down and pick mussels out at high tide. You end up, you know, sort of in a bit of a bind. You got to wait till low tide. So sometimes we'd have to wait a couple of hours and he wouldn't understand why, but that was fun. And anyway, we would have basically just go down to various sites along the harbor, all the way maybe to South Bar a bit, but also into the harbor, which of course Sydney Harbor in and of itself has got some interesting issues with, you know, waste being dumped into it, I think still presently, right? You know, we had to take care for all of those things. But it was basically just sampling these mussels from beds and putting them in storage, cold storage, and bringing them back to Wolfville, to Acadia, for analysis of their tissues.
Larry, can you talk a bit more about that project and the former Sydney Steel Plant for a minute? That facility certainly fed a lot of families here and helped in sending a lot of young people off to college and university, kind of like yourself. But as far as environmental cleanups go, it's significant in seeing that transition from tar ponds to family gathering spaces, and many different industries and researchers played a role for that result that we see downtown today.
Well, I think it was a really big part of my scientific beginning, especially focusing on environmental issues, because, you know, it always sort of made me wonder how we had let that happen to our environment and just sort of dumped the waste products off of, you know, the industrial processes at the Sydney Steel Plant. But as a society as a whole, you know, all over the world, we've learned that and are learning that we just can't do that. We have to be very conscious of our impact on the environment, no matter what we're doing, you know, and making sure we're recycling and reusing and not overusing the Earth's, you know, resources. And I did think, as I followed this the tar pond story over the years, that there had to be choices made to deal with the tar pond site and the reclamation of the land in terms of the creation of the Open Hearth Park is, you know, at least it's a really good legacy to sort of move on from that period of time and have this beautiful area where folks can now enjoy the outdoors, you know, in that estuary, that area of Mugga Creek, right, that at one time flowed into like a little bit of a delta into Sydney Harbor, got really narrowed by a lot of the dumping of things. But you know what? For the remediation of the site, it was one of the approaches, you know, simply not digging up every single ounce of material and destroying it or chemically treating it, because again, the costs of that seem to be quite large and just untenable. But this sort of cleanup of industrial waste sites is, you know, prevalent across the globe and across Canada as well, right? I think about how now the oil sands, you know, they require a lot of water and they've been dumping their water into ponds that are contaminated with these really toxic substances. You know, ducks land on them and they suffer these, you know, really, really bad effects. We as a society and myself specifically as a scientist, we have to be really cognizant of that and not only monitor to make sure that none of these things, when we do have them trapped in sites, are leaking out into the environment, but also helping engineers and other chemists develop technologies to really break these hard-to-destroy chemicals down. And, so again, tar ponds, the waste from tar sands, you know, in Alberta, other chemicals that are used in the manufacturing of Teflon, so-called PFOSs, they're called forever chemicals. They're showing up in our environment. And as a chemist, I'm doing my best not only to figure out how to detect these things, but also how to help treat them and then monitor those breakdown products so that we're not making something actually worse.
And by the way, after Acadia, you still had a way to go in your studies, a very impressive journey from there. So where did your interest in science take you from there after graduating from Acadia?
Absolutely, yeah. So after I left Acadia with my bachelor's degree in chemistry, I just went down the road to Halifax, not very far, and I continued with my studies in a master's degree, also studying under people there doing mass spectrometry. And then I talked about things with my dad, Larry Sr., and he and I had realized that, well, you can get a bachelor's degree, and then you can get a master's degree, and there's actually another degree beyond that. That's the PhD, the doctorate. And so he said, you should probably just go for that. And that was, we really weren't thinking too much about career. We were just thinking about having fun in school. So I looked around North America for schools, and the one school that kind of stood out for mass spectrometry was actually Purdue University. When I applied to Purdue University, I had no idea where it was located. And so I looked at a map, and then I looked up the state of Indiana, which I was really surprised where it was, sort of, you know, I hadn't really focused on the geography of America up to that point. I was like, oh, okay, it's close to Chicago. It's could be a cool place to go. And sure enough, I went there, met the people. The terrain was very different from Nova Scotia, you know, a lot of flat land, a lot of corn, but a lot of really nice people. And sure enough, I went there and studied under some really great scientists and really got my chops. And as soon as I was done at Purdue University, both my wife and I were really kind of clamoring to get back to Canada. And she did her doctoral studies at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. And I also moved there and did my postdoctoral fellowship, which is kind of like an apprenticeship for people with PhDs to learn new skills and learn what else they can do with their knowledge that they've acquired so far and expand their knowledge.
And you held several positions as a researcher eventually, a lot of years in the classroom and in the labs, and you started your own company. It's called Bedrock Scientific. What can you tell us about Bedrock Scientific, Larry?
So Bedrock started in September 2020, just as our pandemic was really getting serious and getting on the go. I had worked in industry for 11 years, had just decided that it was a good time to transition to what I wanted to do, you know, what my passion was. What Bedrock Scientific does is it reaches out to smaller and mid-sized labs and provides expertise. And it also provides them with a way to get access to mass spec knowledge that they wouldn't have otherwise. And so that's what I'm sort of aiming to do. I'm aiming to start to help startups and to help small and mid-sized universities with projects that they just are lacking some expertise with.
No, I got to say, Larry, this conversation reminds me of the time we had Dr. Art MacDonald from Sydney on the program. He eventually went on to win a Nobel Prize in Physics, and he talked about his interest in science starting as well at a young age. He went to Sydney Academy, and he also credited some of his teachers for carving that path for him. And he also talked about coming back to the island for a university project connected to the steel plant. It looks like we punch above our weight class here as far as producing very capable scientists, and you seem to be in pretty good company there.
Oh, I would definitely say so. And, you know, when I was, you know, going through, you know, high school and taking a path in science, there was no shortage of really bright minds coming out of Cape Breton. And it was folks like Art McDonald and others who just sort of, you know, set the path for us. And again, all of our teachers, you know, were fantastic and really sort of sparked my interest. And all of the people who I would ask about the tarpons were always great to share information and their knowledge. And it sort of is what I'm trying to do now with, you know, my own work.
Okay, Larry, I wanted to ask you before you go, you don't spend all of your time in the lab as far as healthy mind, healthy body goes. You're also an avid runner, and this is something you're also very passionate about, correct?
Yes, running is a big passion of mine, Bill, which if, well, you knew me when I was growing up. I was not the runner's shape. I remember, I was just thinking about, do you remember the Canada Fitness Test? Do you remember that awful thing we'd have to do every spring?
Yes,
I can remember getting the sticker so many times, and it was the long distance running that always killed me. And so I don't know how it came to be, but I just started running maybe about 5 years ago, a little bit at first. And now I just really, I cannot get enough of it. I mean, I was out today. We had a lovely minus 12, felt like minus 18 wind chill on the go. And I just bundled up and went for an 8 mile run. And I love it. You can clear your head. You get all the bad feelings out. You get some ideas on the go because the oxygen is pumping to your brain. So, yeah. And also, being in Milton, in this part of the Greater Toronto Area, the GTA, we have access to Toronto, but we also have access to all of this lovely nature and conservation areas. And so my family, we will go to these areas and we will hike and just really make great use of the land that's been set aside along the Niagara Escarpment to just enjoy nature. It's just a fantastic spot.
Right on, Larry. So we're just about out of time here, buddy, but is there anything you'd like to add?
I would just like to say that I'm really honored by this, Bill. I like getting an interview to get myself and my company's name out there, especially to the folks back home, is tremendous, right? There's a real sense of pride here, coming from Cape Breton, but also, you know, the small businesses that have started in Cape Breton and have thrived and really worked hard. And it's just very, I'm a very proud Cape Bretoner.
And if anyone would like to learn more about Bedrock Scientific, how can they go about doing that?
Absolutely, Bill. You can go to www.bedrockscientific.com, or it's just as easy to Google Bedrock Scientific. And I'm also available on Facebook and Instagram, YouTube soon, and Twitter soon.
Okay, thanks for that. We're talking to Larry Campbell from Westmount, now living in Ontario, running his own company, Bedrock Scientific. We appreciate your time very much, Larry. Nice catching up with you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we'll stay in touch, Bill. This is really fun.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.